You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And boy, suddenly it became summer out there. Our shot from the Capitol has changed. Anyhow, it's Friday, so our first hour, Senator Bernie Sanders. I think of him as America's senator. The good people of Vermont know him as theirs. Live over at the Senate studio, Senator Sanders.
Yep. Hey. Good to be with you, Tom.
Thank you for joining us. And we will be taking calls for Bernie right after the first break. Senator Sanders, what's wild news coming out of the Senate?
There is a lot that is going on. As you mentioned, the budget issue is front and center. The House voted to support it. It'll be coming to the Senate, I believe, next week. And I haven't yet, to be honest with you, decided how I'm going to vote on this thing. Clearly, I think no one denies that this budget is an extremely modest effort. It does not in any way, shape, or form address the major crises facing our country. There is no money going in there for job creation or rebuilding our infrastructure or moving aggressively toward energy efficiency. We have not in this budget asked the wealthiest people, the largest corporations in this country, to start paying their fair share of taxes. At a time when we spend on defense almost as much as the rest of the world combined, we have not made the kind of cuts in defense spending that I think would be appropriate. On the other hand, and let me be very clear about this, what I am very proud of is that I and many other people have been working for a number of years against very, very powerful special interests who have wanted to cut Social Security. They've wanted to cut Medicare. They've wanted to cut Medicaid. There are no cuts in this budget in Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and that is not insignificant. We have continued to fight off these attempts, and that's a good thing. One of the areas that is perhaps most disappointing is that we continue to have in this country not only very high unemployment. Unemployment, as I point out every week, is not really 7%. It's much higher than that if you include those people who have given up looking for work and those people who are working part-time. It's over 13%. Youth unemployment, close to 20%. Long-term unemployment in this country is a very, very serious problem. It's at a record-breaking level. And this budget does not include a provision to extend long-term unemployment. And that means that at the end of this year, about 1.3 million people will lose their long-term unemployment and benefits. And that is not only very bad for families who are suffering with long-term unemployment, but it's bad for the economy because that is money that these folks will not be spending. It will result in the loss of about 200,000 jobs. So it's a mean-spirited and bad idea not to extend these benefits. Now, the problem that Patty Murray has had, and Patty is the chair of the Senate Budget Committee, is she's negotiating with folks who want to, as I mentioned earlier, cut Social Security, cut Medicare, cut Medicaid, cut education, cut nutrition programs, give more tax breaks to billionaires, and maintain loopholes for large multinational corporations who in some cases pay nothing in federal income taxes. So she was in a very, very difficult position. But I've got to, you know, over the weekend be thinking about what the best vote is on that. So that's one issue that is out there. I'm chairman of the Veterans Committee. One of the issues that the committee has been dealing with, and veterans throughout this country have been dealing with, is the fact that we have done VA has a very large backlog in terms of benefits claims. I'm happy to say that in recent months they have made some significant progress in closing that backlog. They are in the process of converting their system from paper to digital, and they are now doing a much better job than they previously did. They still have a long way to go, but they are making some good progress. This week, I also, in the midst of all of the discussion about the Affordable Care Act, I reintroduced a single-payer legislation which would provide health care to every man, woman, and child in this country as a right through state-administered single-payer program. And if we do that, you will save per capita substantial sums of money. As I hope everybody knows, our very dysfunctional and complicated and wasteful healthcare system now spends almost twice as much per person on healthcare as do the people of any other country. It has been calculated that if, as a nation, we spent the same amount per person as do people in other countries, Tom, we would be saving over somewhere around $900 billion every single year.
Wow. So that's essentially the subsidy that we're giving to these for-profit corporations.
Exactly. Exactly. So what you have is a system based on profit. The insurance companies make a whole lot of money. And not only do they make a whole lot of money, they distort health care priorities. We have a crying need, a desperate need for more primary health care all over this country. And if you did that, you had the doctors, you had the nurses, you had the clinics, you would actually save money by keeping people out of emergency rooms where Medicaid pays 10 times more per visit than they would if somebody went to a community health center, for example. We do nowhere near as good a job in disease prevention as we should. We have too many specialists in areas that we don't need them, et cetera, et cetera. So we have and among many other concerns in terms of our healthcare system, we have the drug companies in this country charge our people by far the highest prices in the world for prescription drugs. They resist strenuously the efforts to go from brand name to generic, where the prices can be substantially lower for the consumer. So once you have a system geared toward profit, it should not be surprising that we spend so much more per capita, that our healthcare outcomes in terms of life expectancy, infant mortality, and many other problems are worse than in many other countries. Interestingly enough, when many of my colleagues get on the floor of the Senate and they say, we have the best healthcare system in the world. Well, you know what? There's a poll that came out that was done recently by the Commonwealth Fund. And they polled the people in 11 countries, getting their views on how they felt about the healthcare system, just without going into all of the responses. In the United Kingdom, 63%, that's a socialized healthcare system by and large, 63% of the people in the UK thought that their system worked well and needed only minor changes. In the United States, we are at the bottom of 11 countries polled. We were at 25% thought our system worked well, only minor changes. In terms of having the need to completely rebuild the system, that it was so bad it had to be completely rebuilt. In the UK, 4%. In this country, 27%. Other countries that do have much more popular healthcare systems, Switzerland, Netherlands, Austria, New Zealand, Norway, Sweden, Germany, Canada, and France. So we are at the bottom of the list in terms of how people feel about their healthcare system, and yet we spend, for that privilege of being at the bottom of the list, almost twice as much per capita. And that's why I've introduced a single-payer system, single-payer piece of legislation. And the point there is very simple. Number one, in my view, healthcare is a right of all people. And number two, if you're going to guarantee health care to all of our people as a right, you need a cost-effective system, and a single-payer approach is the way to go. So essentially, it would be improving and expanding Medicare, improving and expanding the CHIP program, Children's Health Insurance Program, both of which are popular programs that work pretty well and fairly cost-effectively.
It's brilliant. It's brilliant. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. He will be answering your questions right after this quick break on Brunch with Bernie here on the Tom Hartman Program. Be sure to check out Bernie's website, sanders.senate.gov. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You can also drop into our live chat room over at tomhartman.com. And you can subscribe to Bernie's newsletter, the Bernie Buzz, over at sanders.senate.gov. Welcome back. Laura in Sebring, Florida, watching Free Speech TV on the DirecTV satellite system. You are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hello, Senator. How are you today?
I am great.
Good. I had a question about, I saw a banner come out and say that the Heritage Foundation, Freedom Works, et cetera. Well, he didn't say that, but he said these special interest groups didn't even know what was in the budget agreement, but they had commented on it already. Why are these people running our country, and why can't we get our country back from them?
Well, Laura, that is a very, very good question, and it gets down to campaign finance. It gets down to this disastrous Citizens United Supreme Court decision of several years ago. The simple reality is that big money interests and billionaires have huge influence of what happens in the United States Congress and what does not happen in the United States Congress. To a very large degree, especially in the House, they determine the agenda. And I hope that everybody really understands, and I think many people do not, Tom and Laura, understand what their agenda is. If you look at what the Koch brothers want, if you look at some of these right-wing think tanks, some of which are funded by the Koch brothers or other billionaire-type organizations, this is what they want. And I think people think, well, Bernie, you're exaggerating. I am not exaggerating. They want to end Social Security. They do not believe that the government should play a significant role in protecting the needs of the American people. They want to move us toward an oligarchic form of society where big corporations and the wealthy have virtually all of the economic and political power. That's their agenda. What does that mean? It means you eliminate Social Security, because Social Security is a very effective and successful government program which makes sure that when you get old or when you're disabled or if you're a widow and you have kids, that you're going to get some protection and have some security in your life. They want to end Medicare, because Medicare is a government program that works pretty well in providing insurance to seniors. They don't want the government involved in that. They want to make massive cuts in Medicaid or in Medicaid. Some of them want to privatize the Veterans Administration, which, by the way, provides pretty good quality health care to about 6.2 million veterans throughout this country. They want to eliminate the Environmental Protection Agency because they think it's just fine for companies to dump their crap into our rivers, our lakes, into our air, without any government restrictions. They think it's just terrible. Many of these guys want to eliminate the concept of the minimum wage. And right now, one of the issues, and I'll talk about this more later, that's coming up is, in fact, the need to raise the minimum wage. We're going to have a heck of a fight on our hands. I don't know that we can get 60 votes, but certainly we have to do it. They want to, they say, the $7.25 minimum wage today, which to my mind is a starvation wage, they think it is just too high. And if you're in a high unemployment area and somebody wants to pay you $3 an hour, there is no problem. So, Laura, my point is these guys have a right-wing extremist agenda. A family like the Koch brothers are worth over $70 billion. They are pouring hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars into the political process in Washington, at state capitals, all over this country. They are enormously powerful.
Senator Bernie Sanders with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour here on the Tom Hartman program. We'll be back with more of your questions for Bernie right after this. Tom Hartman here with you, and it's our Brunch with Bernie. Our Senator Bernie Sanders answering your questions. Paul, watching on live stream in Olympia, Washington, you are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. My question is regards how the Republicans won the House of Representatives by redistricting and gerrymandering. And I would like help understanding what prohibits the Justice Department or organizations or individuals from taking on legal action against redistricting and gerrymandering?
Paul, nothing prohibits the Department of Justice from doing that, and I think in the past they have. But as you know, redistricting is done at the statewide level. And frankly, there has always been a certain amount of gerrymandering. Republicans didn't invent that concept. Democrats have done it too. What Republicans have done, as they often do, is just take it to a whole new level. Where the Department of Justice can get involved and have gotten involved is if there is an intentional effort to deny people of color their constitutional rights in terms of representation. If if gerrymandering manipulates districts to deny minorities their constitutional rights, that is an opportunity for the Department of Justice to intervene. So that's kind of where we are. You have a situation now where in the last elections, interestingly, Democrats got, I can't remember, was it, Tom, a million more votes than Republicans?
I think it was like 1.4 million. It was well over a million.
So more people voted for Democratic candidates to the U.S. House than voted for Republican candidates, but Republicans have the majority, and a lot of that has to do with gerrymandering. So it's an issue, though, that has also got to be fought. It's not just the Department of Justice. It's going to have to be fought state by state to see that there are fair districts.
Yeah. Jeff, in Peoria, Illinois, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Good afternoon. I'm a pipe fitter, a union pipe fitter, and for the first time in my 13-year career, I'm looking at an extended layoff period this winter. So I'm concerned about the unemployment extension, and if the budget does make it through the Senate, is there any hope for the extensions on long-term unemployment?
Jeff, thanks very much for the question. What I have been concerned about, the answer is yes, there is hope. And my understanding is that the legislation will come up fairly soon, maybe in early January. But what I worry about is that we have a Republican Party that is certainly not sympathetic to working people and not sympathetic to the unemployed. And it is going to be a very, very tough political struggle, not impossible, but a tough political struggle to get that passed. And the reason I am upset that it's not in the budget is when you're in the budget, it gives you leverage. In other words, the Republicans in the House, for a variety of reasons, primarily, I think, because politically they didn't want to shut down the government. Again, that was a disaster for them politically. They felt they had to pass it. I think there is a good chance they would have passed it if there was an extension, if not a year, at least 3 months of extended unemployment. So we've lost that leverage, and that concerns me. But on the other hand, I think extending unemployment is popular. We have high unemployment in many parts of this country. So, you know, we're gonna absolutely mount that fight, and I hope that we can win it.
Dana in New York City, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Good afternoon, Tom.
Hello, Dana.
Hello.
Yeah, you're on the air.
My question is a question about this thing with the canceled policies and the ACA. Was this loophole that allowed the insurance companies to cancel these policies without just amending them or raising the prices? Was it an accidental oversight in the composition of the bill, or was this a deliberate plug-in compromise that it's resulting in another backdoor subsidy to the private insurance companies to subsidize these junk policies?
Well, you know, I think the intention was, you know, that, which I think makes sense, is to do away with policies that people honestly don't even know how bad they are, which have huge deductibles, which pay out, in some cases, only a few thousand dollars in benefits, which will last you about 12 minutes if you ever enter a hospital. So the feeling was, I think what Obama was thinking is, these are such absurd policies. They're so essentially useless. They're fraudulent in a way because people have expectations. Hey, I have health insurance. They don't know that it covers only $2,000 worth of care. So I think that was the expectation. And I think also in that particular area of individual policies, they change all of the time and people come in and come out of them. So I don't know. I can't tell you what was intentional or not, but I think the goal is certainly to do away with junk policies, which give people the misunderstanding that they have real coverage.
Okay. Bernie, we have just about a little over a minute before the next break.
Let me touch on another issue, which is kind of why I'm here on a Friday afternoon and usually not. And that is this week, as many listeners know, a few weeks ago, the Democrats, with my very strong support, changed the rules in terms of how we can approve presidential nominations to the executive branch and to the judiciary. What we have seen is unprecedented Republican obstructionism. And finally, we changed the rules so that you don't need 60 votes to get these things passed, but you only need a majority. And the result of that is that we have gone very rapidly through many, many nominations to circuit courts, very importantly to the D.C. Court of Appeals, which is the second most important court in the country, and a number of other positions where the president had made nominations, but they were just being delayed by the Republicans. I think that this is a good step forward. My own view is that we've got to go even further.
Senator Bernie Sanders with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour, taking your calls. Senator Sanders taking your calls here on the Tom Hartman Program. We'll be back with more of Senator Sanders right after this. Be sure to check out his website at sanders.senate.gov. It's a great news site and resource, and you can sign up for the Bernie Buzz.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
At sanders.senate.gov. Be sure and check it out. We'll be back. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program, the True People's Media. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Bernie Sanders live from the Senate with us today. And Bernie, back to the calls.
Let's do it.
Okay. Ken, in Great Falls, Montana, watching Free Speech TV on the DirecTV satellite system. You are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. It really bothers me that over in the Bakken in North Dakota, they're flaring over $100 million worth of natural gas every month. That's enough to heat about 500,000 homes. Now, the sad part is there's regulations, but they pretty much have the ability to flare this gas for at least a year before the regulations even kick in. Would you consider putting a tax on this flaring, this total waste of our children's future? I mean, I'd rather go to green stuff, but we're at least going to have that natural gas for a transitional fuel. And the fact that they're wasting this huge amount just so they can get at the oil is an absurd thing that our country's doing.
Okay, Ken, thanks very much. I have to tell you, I did not know as much as what you had told me, but that is an area that we should explore, and I think you make a very good point.
Ashes in Palatine, Illinois. You're on the air with Senator Sanders. Thanks for listening to WCPT.
Right, thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
Senator Sanders, my question is, do you think the healthcare industry is hurt by the for-profit that it's in? Because I see a lot of doctors and insurance companies that they're just in it for the money, and that because they're in it for the money, that's going to produce a different outcome for their patients and the customers.
Well, yes. I mean, I think when you have a for-profit healthcare system, the result is that you have a complicated system. You have a system not designed to provide quality care to all people in a cost-effective way, but a system that will make money, as much money as possible, for insurance companies, drug companies, certain kinds of doctors, medical equipment suppliers, and all of those who can make profits out of the healthcare system. And it really does distort a whole lot of what happens within healthcare. One of the areas, as I mentioned earlier, that I am deeply concerned on, and chairman of the subcommittee that deals with this, is we don't have enough primary health care doctors. We don't have enough dentists. We don't have enough nurses. But on the other hand, in certain areas, we have too many specialists. We charge our people much too much for prescription drugs. So you have a system which is not designed to run cost effectively, to provide quality care, but to make money. And when you have that, you end up with results that we have, spending almost twice as much per person on health care as any other nation, any other major nation, all of whom have, in one way or another, national health care systems. They differ, but that's what they all have. They're not dominated by private insurance companies.
Lynn in Waleka, Florida. Am I saying that right, Lynn, watching us on TV?
Waleka, Florida, Free Speech TV, yes. Thank you. My question has to do with the Trans-Pacific Partnership And from what I've been reading, it sounds like there's everything in it for a corporation and absolute devastation to our labor market and the regulations that we have worked so hard to get to make people safe. And I don't understand our president's desire to fast-track something that sounds like it's going to damage our country drastically. Thank you.
Well, Lynn, I think your very good question gets back to a question that was asked earlier, maybe at the very beginning of the show, by Laura from Florida. And that is about money in politics. And I am sorry to have to tell you that on issues of trade, there really has not been a whole lot of difference between Democrats and Republicans, whether it's Obama or George W. Bush or Clinton or George Herbert Walker Bush or Reagan. These are guys who are supporting the corporate model of unfettered free trade, which to my mind has been a disaster for the middle class and working people of this country, forcing us to compete against countries where people are making 50 cents an hour or a dollar an hour. So I have very strong concerns about the TPP, not only in terms of what it does to American workers and the loss of manufacturing jobs, but also, among other things, prescription drugs and what it does to developing countries. We pay the highest prices in the world for brand-name drugs. What other countries try to do is get generic drugs on the market quicker. What the pharmaceutical industry wants to do is prevent that from happening. And they are working hard to force poor countries around the world to pay far more for prescription drugs than is currently the case. And I think that that is enshrined in the TPP agreement. So this is, from what I can see, a corporate written document. It will not be good for working people in this country or for low-income people in other countries around the world.
Nick in Chicago, listen to WCPT. You're on the air with Senator Sanders. Nick?
Hello, it's Nick and Guy. Nick?
Hey, yeah, you're on the air.
I didn't hear you call my name, Tom. Sorry.
My apologies.
Senator Sanders, the question is, if we have issue with Social Security because money was borrowed, and jobs are going overseas, and the only way really to bolster Social Security is to have working Americans putting back into the system, why can't there be a tariff in order to on imported goods from other countries, even if those goods are or the corporation is here in the U.S., why can't a tariff be put on that so we can start strictly for Social Security?
Okay. Nick, I think you are kind of bringing together issues which kind of should be dealt with separately or in a slightly different way than you are proposing. In terms of the issue of Social Security, let me be very clear, as I have been week after week on this show. Social Security, despite what you may see on Fox television, is not going broke. Yes, of course, people, what Social Security does is invest their very substantial surplus of $2.7 trillion in treasury bonds in order to get an interest payment. And interest provides a substantial amount of money into the Social Security trust fund. That's what they do, and that's what they should do. But Social Security can pay out every benefit owed to every eligible American for the next 20 years. The way we make it stronger for 50 to 75 years is lift the cap on taxable income so we end the absurdity of somebody who's making $1 million a year contributing the same amount into the Social Security Trust Fund as somebody who's making $113,000. That's how you deal with Social Security. I think the issue of tariffs is a slightly different issue, and that is an issue that says, why is it that the middle class of America is disappearing? Why is it that in the last 10 years we have probably lost over 50,000 factories in this country and millions of decent-paying manufacturing jobs? Why is it that the new manufacturing jobs being created in America, and there are some, are paying in some cases 50% less than what older manufacturing jobs used to pay? And that has a lot to do with unfettered free trade. And if you allow companies to go to China or to Vietnam to produce a product and to pay people 25 or 50 cents an hour and then bring that product back into this country without any tariff at all, it should not surprise you that that will drive American companies out of business who are paying people a living wage in this country. So I think you got two separate issues. Number one, we have got to protect Social Security. We've got to make sure it's solvent for the next 50 to 75 years. And I indicated the way I think we should do that. In terms of protecting our jobs, I do think we need to radically change our trade policies and, among other things, establish tariffs.
Dan in Tell City, Indiana, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hello, Bernie. This Dan. I would like to implore you to why don't they do something about the number of lobbyists that corporations can to limit them to say one instead of like five.
Well, Don, the answer for that is that the big money interests who already control the Congress want to have even more influence. And what you're suggesting, if we limited the number of lobbyists significantly, it would diminish their power. Right now, the average working person doesn't have a paid lobbyist fighting for his or her needs. But lobbyists, if you're a multinational corporation, you may be spending zillions of dollars on lobbyists. You're spending a whole lot of money on campaign contributions. You're setting up all kinds of think tanks to influence public policy. So the big money interests have a huge impact on what goes on in Washington, D.C., and they are not of a mind to limit that. Do I think we should limit the number of lobbyists? I certainly do. I think it's a good idea. Do I believe we should move to public funding of elections so that, you know, people like Sheldon Adelson of the Koch brothers can't spend hundreds of millions of dollars? Yes, I do. But we are in a minority in that point of view in the U.S. Senate and certainly in the House of Representatives.
And the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
Senator Bernie Sanders with us. We'll be back with more Brunch with Bernie right after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And check out Bernie's website at Sanders.Senate.gov. You can sign up for his newsletter, The Bernie Buzz, and it's a constantly changing news resource. Things happen, it's there. Welcome back. And Steve, watching Free Speech TV on the DirecTV satellite system. You're in Simi Valley, California. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yeah, hi, Senator Sanders. First, I want to thank you and the other Democrats for hanging tough on these all-nighters that the Republicans are pulling to get President Obama's nominees through. So I do appreciate that. The question I have for you is, and correct me if I'm wrong, but earlier Tom had said for the budget to pass, they would need a quota of 60 votes. I always thought that on the budget, all you needed was 51 votes to get cloture. And if I'm wrong, please correct me. Thank you very much.
Yes, on this issue, you are wrong, Steve. We do need 60 votes for cloture. What has happened, and I don't usually go into Senate process, but let me spend a minute on that because Steve asked an important question. What Reid did appropriately, I think it was long overdue, was say to the Republicans, you cannot continue to obstruct, and deny the President of the United States his constitutional right to bring people on board or to appoint people to the judiciary. That is what they did. And they did it by objecting, requiring 60 votes. We don't have the 60 votes. And they were able to substantially slow up the process. So that was changed in terms of the presidential nominations. What has not been changed is legislative issues. And here you have a very difficult situation. Historically, for most important pieces of legislation, majority won. You got 51 votes, you won. But since President Obama has been in office, virtually every significant piece of legislation has been filibustered by the Republicans, has been objected to by the Republicans, and requires 60 votes. I myself think that the Democrats in the Senate should take a hard look at that and move forward, in fact, to change that rule as well. Historically, again, it took a majority. Now it takes 60 votes. And that means that it is very, very difficult for the Senate to do the work that the American people want us to do. Just give you two examples. Earlier in the show, we heard about a pipe fitter who's worried about not being able to get the unemployment benefits that he may need. I think most Americans would like us to extend unemployment benefits. I am not sure. I hope we can get 60 votes. Not sure that we can. Terms of the minimum wage. Poll after poll shows overwhelming majority of the American people understand that $7.25 is not a wage that people should be forced to live on, that we need to substantially raise the minimum wage to at least $10.10 an hour. That bill is going to come up probably within the next month. I am quite confident that we're going to have a majority of senators supporting that. I am not confident at this point that we will necessarily have the 60 votes that we need to proceed. What do? Do you simply throw up your hands and say, gee, we can't do what the American people want us to do? Or do you say, you know, I'm sorry, if you're going to keep objecting and filibustering, maybe we need to change the law on that. But in this case, we will need, at this time, 60 votes.
10 minutes before the hour, we'll be right back with more of Senator Bernie Sanders on our Brunch with Bernie Hour here on the Tom Harpin Program. Welcome back. Tom Harmon here with you. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us, and Ed in Klamath Falls, Oregon. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Good day, Senator Sanders.
Hey, Ed. How are you?
I noticed that you folks from the House and the Senate have decided to balance the budget based on the more on the backs of the people that are collecting federal pensions. I have to ask you, how much have you reduced the federal pensions for the House and the Senate, you know, your pension, in this little budget deal? And next time the Republicans want to talk about means testing, why don't we means test everything? Why don't we means test the oil depletion allowance? If you're a super rich corporation, you don't need the oil depletion allowance.
Well, Ed, you raise a good question. In terms of congressional pensions, they were substantially changed. I can't tell you exactly about, I'm guessing, 20, 22 years ago. So they were very, very high. They are good now, but not radically inconsistent with the private sector. But you make a good point in terms of federal pensions. One of the concerns that I have when I talked about not being yet decided how I'm going to vote on this bill is the continued attack on federal employees. As I've indicated earlier, the Republicans want to cut many, many significant federal programs. And when you do that, you're attacking the federal employees who administer those programs. And that's Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. It is the Postal Service that they want to significantly downsize. And what has happened in terms of federal employees is that for the previous 3 years, Tom, they got a 0% increase in wages. Now they've gotten a 1% increase in wages, but what this agreement says, and this is one of the very negative aspects of it, is that for new federal employees, they're going to have to pay 1.2% more for out of their incomes for pensions. So the attack continues. Ed is absolutely right. There is a continued attack against federal employees.
Okay. Jennifer in Chicago, listening on WCPT. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Did you say Jennifer in Chicago?
I did. I'm sorry. I'm going to have to start talking louder here.
No. Static. But, yes, this is Jennifer. And Senator Sanders, I agree with you about Social Security and raising the cap. My question is two parts. First of all, are you suggesting that we raise the cap or do away with the cap entirely? And secondly, would they ever consider raising the cap or doing away with the cap but lowering the rate so that it is easier on working class people and not as undesirable to the rich people?
That's a very good question, Jennifer. Here's the proposal that I have introduced. There are different proposals out there in terms of the cap. What I have done for, you know, fairly obvious reasons is I have introduced legislation which has a number of co-sponsors, which is exactly the concept that Barack Obama introduced when he ran for president the first time. And what that does is it eliminates the cap, but it doesn't start at $113,000. It would start at $250,000 a year. So people who earn less than $250,000 would not have to pay more. But the cap would go up at $251,000. That is exactly what President Obama campaigned on the first time he ran for office. Unfortunately, he has since changed his view. Now, what Jennifer is also saying is that right now, working people are paying a pretty stiff 6.2%. Their employers pay 6.2%. And Jennifer is asking, is there a way that we can create a more progressive approach towards Social Security taxes, perhaps lower it for lower income people? That is a very, very good idea and something worth looking at.
Okay. Gary in Sacramento, California. Gary, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Oh, hi, guys. This is awesome. My question is this. I understand globalization, especially from a corporation's perspective. However, back in the days when we had tariffs and taxes and whatever else we had to incentivize the competition coming in from abroad to goods to America, why can't we go back to something like that and even attach the guys that are American corporations?
Well, Gary, that's a very good question, and that is, you know, when we talk about the need to reform our trade policies, that is exactly what we are talking about. For the last many decades, corporate America has, in a variety of ways, been at war against working families in this country. They have worked aggressively to break unions. They have worked aggressively for aggressive taxes and against a progressive tax system, which asks the wealthy and large corporations to stop paying their fair share, but also as part of their attack against working families has been this globalization and unfettered free trade. And what unfettered free trade is about is saying, American worker, you're making $15 an hour or $18 an hour. Guess what? You are now going to have to compete against people in China, in Vietnam, all over the country who make 50 cents an hour or dollar an hour. And the way we can compete is, number one, through trade. We will bring products into this country, drive your employer out of business, and we will reach a situation where your wages, your company is going to have to lower wages in order to be competitive. There was an instance last year where I believe it was General Electric expanded a manufacturing facility in Louisville, Kentucky. And when asked why they were expanding the facility, the fellow from GE said, well, you know, in America now, wages are becoming more competitive with the international community. In other words, because wages have gone down, we can now rebuild in America, and that becomes attractive to us. Well, to my mind, that is a very, very sad state of affairs. That is exactly what the race to the bottom is about, and I'm afraid that corporate America has succeeded to a large degree in that effort.
Senator Sanders, thanks so much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
We'll be back with Anything Goes Friday right after this.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. Edison Factor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartmann.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartmann.com. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartmann here. We're with you. It's the second hour of our program, America's Descent into Third World Status. Yep, tropical diseases are rising among the poor. It's an amazing article over at the Naked Capitalism blog site or website, Naked Capitalism blog website, nakedcapitalism.com. Reader Francois T., who is a doctor as well as a research scientist, confirms that worming tablets, it's something pretty remarkable. Poverty is growing. The percentage of U.S. homes living on less than the World Bank's threshold of $2 per person per day has doubled since 1996. Some 20% of all households with children get by on that or less sometimes. I thought $2 a day was like, the kind of poverty that you'd find in rural China or in the Democratic Republic of Congo, where there's a war going on, the government's paralyzed, you've got famines happening. I mean, it's here in the United States. This is the New Scientist article, America's Hidden Epidemic of Tropical Diseases. They write, when the letter arrives, it must come as a shock. Would-be blood donors are politely rejected because they've tested positive for a deadly tropical infection and their doctors aren't much help. An estimated 330,000 U.S. citizens, possibly as many as a million, carry the parasite that causes Chagas disease. It is a chronic silent infection that leads to lethal heart or gut damage in 40% of cases. It is the most common parasitic disease in the United States or in the Americas, and it can be treated if the doctor is aware of it. Most U.S. doctors aren't. It's amazing. It looks like the flu at first. Symptoms go away, but the disease can live in a person for decades, sometimes reappearing in the form of digestive or heart failure. Sometimes doctors interpret its late onset symptoms as an old age problem. This is amazing. And Chagas isn't the only so-called neglected tropical disease on the march in the U.S., despite the name. These are ailments of poverty, not geography. For instance, they go on, the more the researchers look for these diseases, the more they find. In 2008, Peter Hotez of Baylor College of Medicine made initial calculations of the number of the cases in the U.S. for several NTDs, these diseases of the third world typically. Trichinomus vaginalis and Toxoplasmosis gondii show that many more people have the infection was thought 5 years ago. Much is specific to minority communities. 29% of black American women carry T. vaginalis versus 38% of women in Nigeria. In the U.S., black women are 10 times more likely as white or Hispanic women to have the parasite, which increases the heterosexual spread of HIV and boosts the risk of a low-weight birth weight baby. It can be cured with an oral dose of a common drug that's Flagyl. It's amazing. It's just incredible. Hispanic people in the U.S. are more likely to ingest eggs from the pork tapeworm, which can cause epilepsy if they lodge in the brain. Cysticercosis. One in 10 seizure cases taken to Los Angeles emergency rooms are caused by this parasite. Poor white people in Appalachia, meanwhile, suffer from the intestinal threadworms, strongylitis, stercolaris, and ascaris lumbicosus. I'm sure I'm mangling that. A leading global cause of impaired childhood development. Dengue fever is growing. It's making a comeback. Dengue is being transmitted in Houston. And worse, we've got the worst tuberculosis outbreak in 20 years. In fact, the headline in the Palm Beach Post was "Worst TB outbreak in 20 years kept secret." The CDC officer had a serious warning for Florida health officials in April. A TB outbreak in Jacksonville was one of the worst his group has investigated in 20 years, linked to 13 deaths and 99 illnesses, including 6 children. Amazing. Florida's outbreak was and is far from contained. And then they comment, this is the world that neoliberalism creates. So neoliberalism being, you know, Reaganomics, conservative economic policies. Widening wealth, widening income disparity, and falling levels of social well-being, particularly poorer health, even among the wealthy. Unless the rich decide to embrace these diseases as causes, as Bill Gates has done with malaria and Carlos Slim is taking an interest in Chagas, the policy elites appear to prefer to sweep this indictment of their new world order under the rug as long as they possibly can, even if the neglect is to their detriment. Amazing. It's amazing. That's... Okay, The Guardian. Britain will pay the price for shafting the working class. This piece in the end, and then I am going to pick up your phone calls here for the rest of the show. It's Anything Goes Friday. According to the Sutton Trust think tank, which focuses on social mobility, 68% of leading public school servants went to private schools. 63% of lawyers were privately educated. 60% of the upper ranks of the armed forces. Private schools. In other words, they're the what in England is called the middle class, the what here in the United States we would call the upper middle class, the wealthy, those wealthy enough to send their kids to private schools. Independent schools produce more than half of the nation's leading journalists, diplomats, financiers, and business people. Only 4% of members of parliament previously worked in the manual trades. So they say, you know, there were working class people in representative positions voicing the concerns of people from their communities. Fewer now. What happened? Thatcherism happened. The social geographer Danny Dorling details how the grocer's daughter from Grantham, that would be Margaret Thatcher, fractured the post-war reality of the poor becoming less poor and the narrowing of the gap between the very poor and the very rich. He says, by the time Thatcher left office in 1990, the annual incomes of the 1/100th of 1% of society, the top 1/100th of 1%, had climbed to 70 times the national mean. For them to win, as they did under Thatcher and New Labour, others had to lose. Those who lost were working class communities. It is a zero-sum game. Okay, and then, well, that's enough. Let's pick up your calls here. Mark, let me get over here. Mark in Republic, Washington. Hey, Mark, what's on your mind?
Well, back in the early 80s, when Newt Gingrich was the head of the House, his phone got tapped, and he passed laws to protect him from the criminal acts he was doing on that phone.
Right.
And my question is can we use those same laws against the NSA?
No, we can't, because those laws had to do with making confidential conversations public. In fact, Congressman Jim McGovern, was it Jim McGovern? No, it wasn't. It was... I'm forgetting his name, but anyhow, he's the psychiatrist who's the congressman from Washington State. I'm gonna have to look up his name. Bill Clinton and I did a fundraiser for him to try to pay the $300,000 legal bill because he was the one who released the tape. Somebody down in Florida recorded Newt Gingrich breaking the law, gave it to this congressman, and he released the tape, and it, you know, but Newt sued him. and he had $300,000 in legal bills. But it was because the law was about making it public. So, no, you can't use that against the NSA, Mark. I'm quite sure of that. Say that again? Yeah, Jim McDermott. Okay. Thank you, Jim McDermott. And so, anyway, we'll be right back. It's 15 minutes past the hour on the Tom Hartman program. Anything Goes Friday.
This is the Tom Hartman program.
So, contrails, ghosts. It's Friday the 13th. Come on, we can talk about anything you want. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And happy Friday the 13th. Corky in Rochester, New York, watching us on Free Speech TV. Hey, Corky, what's up?
Hello, Tom. Yeah, I want to talk about what Senator Sanders was saying about these trade deals.
Yeah.
There is no trade deal that is ever going to profit the United States, because there's two conversations that go on at the same time. There's the lobbyist to the politician telling him, if you agree to this trade deal, we're going to create 10,000 jobs in your district. That's going to be good for your election. Meanwhile, in the boardrooms, the corporate bosses are talking about, as soon as this trade deal goes through, we can wrap up our machines and send them there. They're turning us into a distributor rather than a manufacturing that has great costs, such as labor, Social Security, school taxes. We can get rid of all that by shipping our jobs over to this other country.
Right.
So what is going to benefit workers in the U.S.? Nothing. They destroyed our unions so that we couldn't organize and we couldn't demand fair wages. And this is what the middle class is facing. And Washington talks right over our head.
I agree. I absolutely agree. And in fact, that's at the core of my new book, The Crash of 2016, is the destruction of the middle class, the intentional destruction of the middle class, and how that's going to come back and bite everybody's butt, except the very rich. The very rich actually make a profit on crashes and great depressions. But, yeah, I'm totally with you, Corky. I think you said it very well. Thanks a lot for the call. Larry in Santa Monica. Hey, Larry, you had a question about these financial crises of the 70s?
Yeah, hi, Tom. Saw you out here in Santa Monica in November and enjoyed your talk.
Thank you.
Just had a question about the 1970s economic crisis. Was it, in fact, used to implement Reaganomics?
Well, I would say to a large extent. I mean, had the Arab oil boycott and that price shock not echoed through as inflation, Jimmy Carter would have been in much better shape. Although the fact of the matter is that going into that election, unemployment was either 3.6 or 3.8%. It was under 4% in the 1980 election. So, you know, the end of the 70s wasn't all that terrible, although you had a relatively high inflation. And it was just kind of ringing the Fed had cranked interest rates up to try to wring that inflation out, and they did. But that was caused by the oil price shocks, and they were used absolutely by the corporatists and by the Republicans to say, hey, you know, something's wrong, give us a chance, we'll fix everything. And people ultimately gave Reagan a chance. You know, the Iran hostage thing I think played big in it, but they gave him a chance and he did. Did I answer your question, Larry?
It did. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thanks a lot for your call. I think, you know, Naomi Klein wrote an entire book about this called Shock Doctrine. And, you know, what this is called is she called it the Shock Doctrine. It's vulture capitalism in a very, very real way. It's coming in on the back of a crisis, creating a crisis if necessary. Coming in the back into that crisis and saying, because of this crisis, you need to let us privatize our schools and do away with Social Security and cut people's pensions and throw Detroit into bankruptcy and steal off and sell off, buy, give it to us on pennies on the dollar, all the stuff in the art gallery, and on and on and on it goes. 20 minutes past. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you and Arthur in Homewood, Illinois. Hey, Arthur, what's up?
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to ask Bernie Sanders, the biggest problem we have in this country is jobs. Now, the last time that you
the figures came out how many jobs. 41% was government jobs. We need jobs in the steel mills. We have no steel mills. I live here in Chicago all around. We used to have we had Midwest Steel. We had United States Steel. They're all gone.
Mm-hmm.
We have to open up the pipeline of oil. We have to refine oil. We have to open up the...
We're refining oil like crazy, Arthur. You know what the number one export from the United States is?
Yeah, steel.
No, the number one export from the United States last year, and presumably this year as well, is refined petroleum products, principally diesel fuel and gasoline.
Okay. Then why doesn't Obama stop it?
Well, I'm all in favor of an export tariff on oil and any other natural resource out of the United States, and an import tariff on manufactured goods. I mean, that would bring our jobs back. I'm all in favor of that.
Yeah, but you can't bring them back, Tom.
Sure you can.
Real cheap, and people are. You see, if I wouldn't buy, I wouldn't buy a product made unless it was made in this country, because I'm a union man. But I own three stores. I haven't opened up three stores. I was in the food business since I was 14, which was 1943.
Mm-hmm.
And I grew up. I worked hard. Okay, so I joined the union because, but I didn't like the union bosses. Okay, the union is good, but one thing with Social Security, if I may progress on that, how many disability money is coming out of Social Security? What's the percentage?
It's about a third of all Social Security payments are widows, orphans, and disabled people.
No. I say disability.
Yeah,
kids that have a disability of alcoholism. That's a disease, you know.
Yeah.
And obesity is a disease. I know.
Arthur, thanks a lot for the call. Steve in Haymarket, Virginia. Hey, Steve, what's up? I'm not even, you know, I've just reached a point where I just don't even do these debates anymore. It's like, why bother? I'm sorry, Steve, what's up?
Okay. You were talking about single payer the other day.
Yeah.
Why not give every man, woman, and child in the United States a $5,000 debit card that you would then use to go get a complete physical, and then buy a catastrophic health care plan, over $5,000. That way, you would ultimately wind up with $325,000 at age 65 in your bank account.
You asked why, and the answer is really simple. You're suggesting that we continue to have for-profit insurance companies providing this insurance. No other country, developed country, in the world does that. It's against the law in every other developed country in the world. And that's why in every other developed country in the world, they have lower health care costs than we do. Their people are not burdened by the cost of supporting billionaires like Stephen Hemsley, who runs United Healthcare, and the millionaires who work for him. And these guys are just banksters. I mean, you know, it's like this for-profit system is broken. It is just plain old broken, and it's being used to rip off the American people. Dennis in Elmhurst, Illinois. Hey, Dennis, what's up?
Yes, Tom, appreciate you taking my call.
Sure.
Bernie Sanders, the next time you're talking to him, would you ask him, I think that the Veterans Administration has negotiated with the drug companies for their drugs.
Oh, they've been doing that for decades.
Right. Now, we have Medicare Part D. With a lot of people on that, why can't they negotiate the cost of drugs for people on Medicare Part D?
Billy Towson.
Pardon?
Billy Towson. Billy Towson was a congressman from, I think, Louisiana, who was put in charge of pushing Medicare Part D through Congress during the George Bush administration when the Republicans controlled the House of Representatives. And he wrote into this law, this provision, that the government cannot negotiate the price of drugs. They have to buy at retail. So if aspirin sells for, you know, 50 cents a tablet at retail, but the Veterans Administration is paying 1/100th of a penny per tablet because they buy 5 million pills a year or 50 million pills a year, still Medicare has to pay the, you know, 50 cents a tablet. They can't pay the you know, penny a tablet. And he wrote that into the bill. And when that legislation got passed, his term had not yet finished, and he went to whoever was the Speaker of the House at that time, the Republican, maybe it was Boehner, and asked for it was either Boehner or Tom DeLay, and asked for special permission from the Ethics Committee to resign from Congress before his term was over, so that he could take a $2 million a year job as the chief. As the CEO of pharma, or the head lobbyist or whatever for the pharmaceutical lobbying group, pharma. And Congress said, fine, you know, here's your early retirement, and off he went.
Well, can that be changed? I mean,
it can be changed. Yes, it can be changed. And there have been efforts to change it that have been put forward by the Democrats on a number of occasions, and they always, in the Senate, they get filibustered by the Republicans, and under Republican control in the House of Representatives, they will not even be brought up for a vote by John Boehner. This is a $600 billion a decade subsidy for Big Pharma, and Big Pharma then recycles that money into the pockets of largely Republican politicians. And this is also a great example. The Medicare Part D was something that the Democrats opposed, and this was the principal reason they opposed it, was because they saw that, you know, it was great that we were giving, you know, we were paying for the drugs for elderly people, but it was being done in a way, you know, complete with the donut hole and everything else, it was being done in a way that was a giant welfare program for a trillion-dollar industry. And so the Democrats opposed it. But when it passed, the Democrats said, okay, this passed. We're going to do everything we can to try and make it better. And one of the things they've tried to do to make it better is to do away with that you can't negotiate thing over the years. But at least they said, okay, it's the law of the land. They didn't say we're going to, blow up the debt ceiling because we don't like Medicare Part D. I mean, this is the difference between the Democratic Party and the Republican Party, for better or for worse. The Republican Party is doing, 40 times they voted to end Obamacare rather than fix it or do anything. And, there's no incentive at all on the part of the Republican Party to change that. The $600 billion is a lot of money. Dennis, thanks for the call. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
We had Billy Towson on this program, in fact, about 6 months ago, and he was kind of like, "Oh no, I don't remember that. I didn't know." Okay, Arapaho High School. Another school shooting. Surprise, surprise. This is in Colorado, the state where the NRA just got two Democratic members of the state Senate kicked out, recalled, because they dared to vote for a gun control measure. At least one person, a minor, has been taken to Littleton Adventist Hospital with a gunshot wound, a hospital spokesman told CNN. Authorities believe two people have been injured in a shooting. The shooter has apparently committed suicide. I've been saying, all along, most of these, the school is 10 miles from Littleton, where Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold killed 12 students and a teacher in Columbine High School in April of 1999. I've been saying for a long time, these are suicides. What we're seeing with these shootings in the United States, and this was apparently a student in the high school who did this, what we're seeing with these shootings is the same thing that Iraq is seeing with suicide bombings. I mean, Iraq has a 7,000-year-long history. For 7,000 years, Iraq has been, it was the cradle of civilization, of Western civilization. The Epic of Gilgamesh takes place in Iraq. In those 7,000 years, Iraq had never seen a suicide bomber until we invaded and just ripped that country apart, tore apart its social fabric, tore apart its middle class. And now 30 years of Reaganomics, 32 years of Reaganomics, 33 years of Reaganomics here in the United States, and what do we have? Suicide bombers. Except instead of bombs, in Iraq, it's not that hard to get stuff to make bombs. You get old landmines or whatever, and you take the stuff out, and, explosives are readily available. Rockets, grenades. Here in the United States, explosives aren't so available. But we got a lot of guns. So instead of strapping the explosives taken out of a bunch of hand grenades to a person's chest and walking into a school and blowing himself up, instead, the person goes in with a bunch of, high-powered rifles with 30 or 50 clip or round clips, kills a bunch of people, and then shoots themselves. These are suicide bombings. I don't know why Americans are not putting two and two together. Why there's no discussion in our media about how Iraq and Afghanistan had never before had suicide bombers until we invaded those countries. And now they have suicide bombers. And here in the United States, we really seriously never had suicide bombers before Reaganomics. And now we've got suicide bombers, only our version of it is shooters, school shooters. Or mass shooters, let's say. These are people who ultimately are, they're trying to commit suicide. And in many cases, they actually just kill themselves. And in other cases, they're doing suicide by cop. But these are suicides. This is like the amped up gun-based version of what Joe Stack did. He was an early, there's a whole chapter about Joe Stack, not a chapter, but he opens a chapter in my book, The Crash of 2016, The Plot to Destroy America and What We Can Do to Stop It, about how Joe Stack became America's first suicide bomber. I mean, he actually flew a plane into the IRS building and killed one guy who was working at the IRS, decent family man, and killed himself. Literally a suicide bomber. But I'm telling you, this is what's going on in Colorado right now. Anyway, it's anything goes Friday, and it's Friday the 13th. By the way, I've always found Friday the 13th to be really, really lucky. I was at the optometrist yesterday, was it, or the day before yesterday? I forget. And I think it was just whatever. Yeah. Anyhow, so much for my sense of time, right? One day this week, I went to the eye doctor, and as I was leaving, one of us said to the other something about, have a good Friday the 13th. And I said, I've always found Friday the 13th to be lucky. Or no, he said it first, actually, the optometrist. He said, I've always found Friday the 13th to be lucky. And I said, yeah, I have actually signed the incorporation papers for two of the businesses of the seven businesses that Louise and I have started in the many, four decades we've been married, on Friday the 13th. Once inadvertently, completely by mistake, and another time, well, what the heck. And both those are two of our most successful businesses. So what have your Friday the 13th experiences been? Maybe Friday the 13th is a really lucky day. I am of the opinion that Friday the 13th came out of the story of Esther and that Friday the 13th was the day that Haman got hanged. And so it was a good day for the Jews, which is why in the anti-Semitic traditions of the Middle Ages, it got recast largely by the Catholics. I mean, this is before there was anything other than the Catholics and the Christian Church. It got recast as a bad day. But there are other stories about, the origin of Friday the 13th as well. But that one makes particular sense to me. Harvey in Berkeley. Hey, Harvey, you wanted to talk about the universe being a hologram. I saw that article about the universe as a hologram a couple of days ago.
Yes, I find that quite interesting. But actually, I'd like to talk about Newtonian physics and quantum physics, quantum reality. I guess that leads into the holographic universe. Sure. Up till now, our system is, in a sense, keeps us all separate. We all feel that we're separate from each other. And that's part of
our system.
Of
what do you mean by that?
Physics. Well, the media, the nature of capitalism, there's winners and losers,
right.
There's different racial groups, there's different sexual groups. It's like we all look at each other as a kind of a separate entity.
Right.
And that exists on the Newtonian level. Everything is quantifiable, measurable, everything is separate. But we're living in a new era now, the era of quantum physics, and I feel that this is all about, there's a strange property of quantum physics called entanglement, where quantum physics deals with the smallest particles in the universe. And say you take two electrons that are entangled, or two photons. When you separate them out, it could be across the room or across the universe. When you affect one, when you measure one, the other is the opposite. It's instantaneous, no matter the distance. And this is an interesting thing because these quantum particles, like it means that, well, you and I are made of quantum material, and therefore we have the possibility to be entangled with everybody and everything. And at the same time, another property of quantum is that in the Newtonian world, when you have a light switch, it's either on or off. But in the quantum world, it could be on, off, or off. In other words, it has the ability for electron, once again, to be both on and off at the same time. And if that's true, then, and I believe they carry out experiments to prove this out.
Yeah, the slit theory is electrons as waves or particles. Yes.
Uh-huh.
And the thing that changes them is that always turns them into particles is when they're observed.
That's right. And this on-off thing is very interesting. The ability to be in two positions at once, which means that we, since we're made of quantum material, we can be two places at once. And that's why I always feel that I have one foot in the physical and another foot in the metaphysical, and that the Aboriginal people of Australia always talk about the dream time as a waking reality. And so we go from one to the other, back and forth. And this is a kind of a quantum movement. And, we might live, there's a possibility that we live in a multiverse, and that when you make a decision, say, I want to stay home, or should I go out? Well, there's a possibility that you play out both in the quantum, in the multi universes, and that in one universe you stay home, in another universe you go out. So it's really wide open, and I think that this form of entanglement is really interesting, especially if you put it together with Rupert Sheldrake, who's a British scholar, and he studies consciousness. He talks about morphic fields, that we're not just contained by our body, but we carry a field around us. And he said that people who are entangled, their morphic fields are very strong. So like you and your dog seems to know what you're thinking. Or you might be sitting in a cafe and you're thinking, oh, I wonder how Bob is, and suddenly in comes Bob, or
Bob calls. Yeah.
Yeah, and this is all.
Did you see the thing about gravity and string theory and quantum mechanics and wormholes in, I think it was in one of the letters to the AAAS journal? I don't remember where I saw it. I saw it in the last week. Do you know what I'm talking about?
No, I didn't.
Okay, here's this amazing thing. Gravity is the outlier in an attempt to have a unified field theory or unified theory that uses quantum quantum mechanics to explain the universe. And they can describe strong forces at a near distance, but not at great distances. How can that happen? How can the gravity of the sun affect Pluto? Or how can the gravity of the center of the galaxy affect us, you and me? I mean, a hair on your head. And that had not been answerable until they said, if using entanglement, quantum, this whole concept of entanglement, you take two particles, separate them, they go flying off into space, but they are entangled. They're still connected to each other. When that happens, and they did this with quarks, when that one particle is broken into two and they go flying off in opposite directions, a wormhole is created, which connects the two of them through time space. Not by time space, but independent of time space. So they are always instantaneously connected. And if every particle in the universe is entangled with something else at the most elementary level, then that entanglement can account for gravity in the math equations, Harvey. It's amazing. You got to look it up. Anyway, we'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And if that theory is right, it means not just that occasionally you can create entangled, particle. It means literally everything is part of everything. And welcome back. Dennis in Marion, Indiana, watching Free Speech TV on the Direct TV system. Hey, Dennis, what's up?
Hey, how you doing, Tom? Just a couple of comments, nothing quite as deep as before. I was wondering, since Steve, you made the comment that we seem to be repeating history over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering why, when our jobs went overseas, why we didn't start doing some type of tariff tax on the product coming back, so that what we were paying for was the actual price of what an American would be paid if he was making that product, like they did in the 30s.
Yeah. Well, the tariff laws were put into place, and I opened one of the books. I wrote a book called Rebooting the American Dream. And, in fact, Bernie Sanders read from it in his famous filibuster on the floor of the Senate. And he gave a copy of it. We actually gave the copy, but he wrote a letter that went along with a copy of it that was given to each one of the other 99 senators and members of the United States Senate. This was about 3 or 4 years ago the book came out. And the opening chapter of the book starts with Alexander Hamilton and his what's called his report on manufacturers, if you want to look it up. And back in 1791, when the Republic was brand new and George Washington was our first president, Washington went to Hamilton and said, how do we build this country? You know, let's make this thing work. And Hamilton thought about it for a while and came back, and actually it was in 1791, Hamilton came back with his 11-point plan on manufacturers. And he laid out, and he said, let's put tariffs on imported goods. So if it costs a dollar of labor to make a pair of shoes in Connecticut, and that pair of shoes can be made in Mexico with 50 cents worth of labor, or it can be made in China with 20 cents worth of labor, then when that pair of shoes gets imported from Mexico, there's a 50-cent tax, tariff, import tax. If it comes in from China, there's an 80-cent import tax. The import tax, the tariff, will reflect the cost of the labor and the other costs of doing business in the United States. And among other things, he said, let's subsidize new industries that we really want to have here in the United States that we don't have right now, that we need, whether they're for national security reasons, you know, like a defense industry, or whether it's just, you know, for quality of life reasons. Let's subsidize, you know, these industries. There's all 11 steps. You can read it all in the book. And the book is online for free, by the way, over at truthout.org. If you don't want to buy a copy, or you can pick up a copy in the library. But I laid this whole thing out, and it's like from 17 and to within 2 years, George Washington had put this into place in 1793. So from 1793 until the 1980s, we had an average tariff of around 30%, 30 to 35% on all imported goods into the United States. Reagan started taking that apart with most favored nation status treaties with individual countries. Clinton put it on steroids after the election of 92. The big debate in the election of 92 between Clinton, Bush, Poppy, and Ross Perot was about tariffs. And Ross Perot said, if you lift these tariffs, you join the World Trade Organization, you sign GATT, you go for NAFTA, if you do that, which Clinton did in 96, if you do that, you are going to hear this giant sucking sound from the South and, you know, implicitly from all the poor countries, and that's going to be our jobs leaving. So Ross Perot was right, and he had 20% of the vote on it. So anyhow, in answer to your question of why haven't politicians fixed this problem, it's because as these corporations got more and more profitable and the middle class got poorer and poorer and lost its ability to unionize, the spokespeople for the middle class, which was the unions, got wiped out. They're the only ones calling for tariffs anymore, other than Bernie Sanders. And the corporations are running the show. 10 minutes before the hour, welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you on the place where despair is not an option, especially on Friday the 13th. Let's check in with Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. You can give a gift of a goat to a returning slave in South Sudan. Goatsfortheoldgoat.com is the only group that gives you a picture of your goat and the recipient. And Ellen Ratner runs it, in fact. Hey, Ellen, how you doing?
Thank you so much. Quite a bit, actually, going on here. What is going on is that we have a State of the Union Day, and the State of the Union Day is going to happen on the 28th, the last Tuesday of January. We thought it was going to be on the 21st. The speaker being a quote-unquote invited the president, which means the president.
Ellen, we're losing you. Okay. Ellen is in the train, and I think that we've lost Ellen. So, Ellen, you can call back, try it, but we can't hear you anymore. So, that said, I'm going to go back to Anything Goes Friday. Cy in Minneapolis, Minnesota, listening to KTNF. Hey, Cy, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I think in the last 2 or 3 weeks, you have mentioned that the Federal Reserve gives back its gained interest from the American economy.
Right. The profit that the Fed makes every year, they redeposit with the Treasury Department.
Then
outside of their own operating expenses.
Then is that contrary to what we always hear about the Fed as bad, the creature from Jekyll Island, how it's voraciously taking
over? I don't think the attacks on the Fed the basis of the attacks on the Fed have not been that the Fed is making a profit and therefore it's bad. They have been more that, you know, the Fed acts in the interest of the banksters of the world rather than the interest of the average American, to super simplify.
Oh, so that it's not that they're collecting more and more interest.
No, nobody. To the best of my knowledge, nobody has been complaining. You know, for example, when Dennis Kucinich and Bernie Sanders and Ron Paul worked so hard to get that 1 year audit of the Fed, it had never been audited before, to get that 1 year audit of the Fed, and they were able to successfully audit it for the year 2008. And what they discovered was not that the Fed was making a profit, but that the Fed was giving money basically at zero interest, not just to banksters, and not just to banks, but to individual banksters, to individual billionaires. They were, you know, who had been caught short. It was giving money to Deutsche Bank. It was giving money to the Bank of Pakistan. It was giving money to the Bank of Iraq. It was giving money to banks of countries that we didn't even like. And it was incredible. And it was giving money to corporations, and presumably continues to do so. So those are the kind of things. You know, they operate without transparency. They operate in ways that when the Fed was created, the enabling legislation, and that produced the Fed. And let's not conflate, by the way, the Jekyll Island thing you're talking about, 1944, that was really making the dollar the standard currency of the world. It took the world off the gold standard for all practical purposes. And that was the creation of the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank and all that kind of stuff. The Fed was created back in 1913, as I recall. And the purpose of the Fed was basically to be a central bank for the United States, to provide the currency to the United States and to stabilize the currency for the United States. And the enabling legislation that created the Fed, which was passed on Christmas or New Year's Eve, you know, in the last minute of the last, that kind of thing, that enabling legislation says that there are two jobs for the Fed. Oh, Ellen's back on. Hang on just a minute. Cy, I'm going to get back to this topic after the news at the top of the hour here. But whoop, Ellen just dropped off. Ellen was there? Okay, I'll continue then. Cy is still with us. You still with us, Cy?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So the legislation that created the Fed said that the Fed has two jobs. By controlling our currency and thus stabilizing our currency and presumably our economy, interest rates and things like that, its two jobs are, number one, to maintain a low level of unemployment, and number two, to maintain a low level of inflation. They did want there to be a certain amount of inflation because that, you know, if you have deflation, that's called a depression. But they didn't want to have too much. And up until the Greenspan era, the Fed did both those things. And when inflation went up, the Fed would try to wring the inflation out by raising interest rates. But on the other hand, when unemployment went up, the Fed would drop interest rates to stimulate the economy, which they're in full-blown mode right now, arguably, and thus reduce unemployment. The Fed hasn't, you know, for about 20 years, the Fed really hasn't paid much attention to that second mandate to reduce unemployment. They've been doing it under Bernanke with this quantitative easing and things like this. This is all about unemployment. But it's still, you know, as they've said, they can't make up for the damage that the Republicans are doing with our tax policies and with our economic policies. Making sense?
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Cy. Great to hear from you, and thanks for listening to KTNF. Eric in Minneapolis, another one in Minneapolis, listening on AM 950. Hey, Eric, what's up?
Hey, good afternoon. Yeah, it's just wanted to comment on the Reaganomics. It really, the Reaganomics, it's the Paul briefs that were drafted that have been followed, implemented by Reagan, and thus followed by every president thereafter.
The what? That have been drafted?
Pardon me?
You said it's the something that has been drafted, and I missed that word.
Powell briefs, the Powell papers.
Lewis Powell?
Yeah.
Okay, so yeah. So you're talking about the policies that Lewis Powell laid out in his memo in 71.
Exactly, and yeah. That's when Reagan took office. He started implementing implementing those policies and procedures, and they've been followed to a T by every president thereafter.
I agree. I just wrote a book about this, The Crash of 2016. That's the premise of the book. You know, the title is The Plot to Destroy America and What We Can Do to Stop It. And the beginning of the plot is Lewis Powell.
And then they're brilliant. And then we have, you know, Sigmund Freud studied the psychology of the single individuals. And what was it? His son-in-law, Edward
Bernie, who...
Henry Bernays. It was his nephew.
Yeah, his nephew studies the control of the masses.
Yes, and Edward Bernays invented the modern public relations industry on behalf of Woodrow Wilson in order to sell World War I to the American people, who are very opposed to it. And I'm with you, Eric. It's more than just Reaganomics, but Reaganomics is certainly very, very symptomatic of it. Thanks a lot for the call. Thanks for listening to Minnesota's progressive voice, AM 950. We'll be back. It's Anything Goes Friday. Anything Goes Friday the 13th here on the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman Program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. Edison Factor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartman.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartman.com. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
This is very interesting. Over at the Financial Times, there's a long report about how the defense authorization bill that just passed the House and is over at the Senate, it's presumably going to pass the Senate without any problem, has not specific like here's money to close Guantanamo, but did away. This one doesn't have the you cannot close Guantanamo language in it. And so there's a lot more flexibility for the executive branch, the president. You know, Congress isn't going to take the initiative. They're not going to be the ones to say we did it. But by not saying you can't do it, the president, the executive branch, can close Guantanamo, can close Gitmo. It is, after all, part of the military, which is part of the executive branch. The executive branch, the president, can close Gitmo, and especially the Republicans in Congress don't, quote, take the blame for it. The president gets to take the blame or the credit or whatever you want to call it. I think Gitmo is a blot. I mean, for any country, this is the kind of thing that you would expect from North Korea, right? They've got a prison camp that's outside their own country so that they don't have to respect the laws of their own country at that prison camp. And they keep prisoners there who have not only not been convicted of any crime, but have been cleared of all crimes by the courts of that country. And yet they still keep them as prisoners. That's what we're doing at Guantanamo. And the rest of the world is looking at us going, well, we could sort of understand George Bush doing this because he was a crazy fascist. But Obama? And Obama's like, I'm trying to close it, but Congress keeps saying you can't. Because you got these Republican congressmen who are just terrified that these terrorists might get into our prison system and somehow be prisoners like, you know, the hundreds of other terrorists who are already in our prison system, who are prisoners who have never escaped. Come on. Really? We're that scared? We're so terrified? We are so small? Well, in Republican land, yes. On Fox News, there's always something to be afraid of. Even if it's something as silly as, hey, maybe Santa Claus wasn't a white guy. No, we can't have that. Anyway, if anything goes Friday the 13th, so to you, Vicki in Mondovi. Am I saying that right, in Wisconsin?
Mondovi.
Mondovi. What a cool name for a city or a town.
There's another. It has another city in Italy by the same name.
I'm not surprised. It sounds Italian. That's great. Mm-hmm. So what's up, Vicki?
speaking of history, I just read a book. I was wondering if you've read it, Lawrence in Arabia by Scott Anderson.
No, I have not.
Oh.
Is it about D.H. Lawrence?
No, you haven't been doing anything lately, but you've got to get to that sometime.
Yeah.
I don't know how long he took to write this book, but it's incredible going over the politics of the of Britain and her allies during the First World War.
Right. Yeah, D.H. Lawrence was, that was during and after World War One, right?
Yes, yes. Well, it was actually during it, and they were fighting fronts in Europe as well as on the African continent.
Right.
And Lawrence took it upon, took it upon himself to help fight in Africa and for the British, but found out how underhandedly they were treating the African nationals, and he just decided that wasn't fair and decided to do a little work on his own.
So he went all Aaron Burr on them.
Fascinating, the history.
Yeah.
The documents that this man has found, uncovering the ineptitude of some of the men in power during that war.
Wow. What's the, if you could, in a sentence or two, summarize the take-home message, the thing that made you want to call and recommend the book. What was it?
His thoroughness. My impression that good grief, we don't learn from our mistakes.
So the British were making mistakes in the same part of the world that we're now, you know, Iraq, Afghanistan kind of thing. They were making the same kind of mistakes that we're making now?
Major.
Yeah.
Major, especially like, from the standpoint of dealing with the racist card.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they are inferiors.
Mm-hmm.
They don't know how to wage a war.
Yeah.
We'll just take care of them till they can take care of themselves.
Right.
And it's incredible that this was 1914,
mm-hmm.
and this is 2013.
Yeah, a century apart.
And here we are.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, by the way, I was born on the 13th of the month, so it's a great day.
Okay, so Friday the 13th is a good one for you. Okay, Vicki, thanks for sharing that. I'm going to have to look for that. Lawrence in Arabia. Thank you very much for the call, and thanks for sharing that. Bruce in Chevy Chase, Maryland. Hey, Bruce.
Yeah, speaking, Tom. It's nice to talk to you. Thank you.
Happy Friday the 13th.
Yeah. Listen, I have a story about Friday the 13th. I was living in Spain quite a few years ago in the capital, Madrid, and I was walking down the street in the center of town, just next to the Puerta del Sol. And I suddenly noticed to my right a long, long line of people lined up to a tobacco shop. Well, in Spain, tobacco shops also sell lottery tickets. And I was wondering, what is going on here? And it suddenly hit me. It's Tuesday the 13th.
Hmm.
Well, in Spain, Tom, Tuesday the 13th is considered a lucky day.
Well, that's
interesting. As compared to Friday the 13th here.
Huh. And any idea why?
Dom, that was my question for you. Do you have any idea why Friday the 13th is considered unlucky here? I found that interesting in Spain, that disparity, but yeah. I have no idea.
Well, one story that was told to me years ago, and I don't find a lot of corroboration for this, you know, poking around on the internet, but it was told to me by a Hasidic rabbi in who lives in Jerusalem, actually, who lives in Mir Sharim, I think it's called, the Hasidic community there, when Louise and I were visiting, was that if you read the Book of Esther, she was Jewish, and she was the queen of a non-Jewish king in a community where the Jews were a minority, and I forget who they were, the something or others, you know, the Hittites or something. And there was this guy named Haman who wanted to kill all the Jews. And so he went to the king and he said, there are these strange people among us, and they're not us, and, you know, please give me the authority to kill them. And the king was like, oh, I didn't realize. Okay, fine, go ahead. And so Haman builds this giant gallows to hang. He's going to start out with Mordecai, who is Esther, the queen's uncle. And Mordecai is sitting by the gate at the city saying, you know, repent, repent all the time. He's a little crazy, but he's like, you know, he's the. And so Mordecai is going to be killed. And when Esther finds out about this, she goes to the king and she says, Haman wants to kill me. And the king says, well, we can't have that. And so he has Mordecai, you know, who is going to be killed, lead a horse around or a donkey or something with Haman on the back of it saying, you know, Haman's a terrible guy, and Haman gets hanged on Friday the 13th. Or at least this is the story that this was on Friday the 13th. And so it was kind of like a good day, a lucky day, and I'm sure I'm mangling the story. It's been a lot of years since I read the Book of Esther. But then the Christians came along and said, well, if that's a good day for Jews, it must be a bad day for us. And so it got flipped during the anti-Semitic era of the Middle Ages. And so that's one theory that actually I've heard from a couple of sources, but I think that's a good one. Bruce, thanks for the call. I don't have a better one.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Although there's probably a whole bunch of them out there. I'm sure people are Googling them and finding them, and who knows what all. But I kind of like that. We'll be back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And these gentlemen would have supported King George. Vegas man commenting, huh? A lot of interesting stuff going on in the chat room right now. Anyway, back to Free Speech TV. John, in St. Louis, Missouri, watching on Dish Network. What's up, John?
Yeah, how you doing, Tom? The reason why I'm calling is a while back I told you that we had a problem here with the Republic Waste Management Service here. They have a landfill that had caught fire and had been burning, and next to the landfill was a radioactive dump site.
Yikes.
What has happened, you know, everybody was kind of like, well, we're worried about it. Well, they brought the EPA in, and the EPA was saying, well, you could dig a trench to, as like a fire break between the radioactive dump site and your waste site. Well, when they started digging the trench, guess what they found? They found more radioactive material in the area that where it wasn't supposed to be. Now they found out that it's gotten into the water system here in the St. Louis area. The mayor of St. Louis is not saying anything about it. The county executive is not saying anything about it. Most of the politicians are saying anything about it. The only politician right now in the state is Chris Costner, the state's attorney general, has been pursuing this. But this is just getting to be outrageous. Now we find out that our water is radioactive. This reminds me of back in New Jersey when they had the dioxin stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
Love Canal.
It's getting to be ridiculous.
Yeah, yeah. So is there any national media that's covering this, John? Any place I can go to find some corroboration for what you just said?
No national media at all.
Is there any local media that's covering it? I mean, how can...
Just the St. Louis Post-Dispatch.
The St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Okay,
that's it.
I'm going to have to do some... make a note about that, St. Louis. During the break, I'll have to track this down. Thank you for the call, and thanks for sharing it with us and, you know, with all of our viewers and listeners. Fred in Fullerton, California. Hey, Fred, NSA?
Yes, Tom. I just had a question as far as the role of NSA in their surveillance. And I know they would listen to every communication, whether email or website testing or whatnot. I was wondering why somebody at NSA did not pick up the phone and call the White House and say, hey, your Obamacare website is not up and running and has major problems.
Yeah. Well, first of all, they don't listen into every call. They simply log every call so that they can build a what's called a metadata database, which, you know, so if you're calling somebody who is then calling a terrorist, then maybe, you know, they should keep an eye on you, that kind of thing. Okay. So, number one. And number two, I'm assuming you meant this kind of tongue in cheek.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. All right. It's a good one. It's a good one. Cause, you know, the NSA's agenda is not necessarily to do what's best for the Obama administration. In fact, I'll bet that there's a lot of Republicans inside the NSA. Maybe more than Democrats. So, you know, it's But it's an interesting question. I mean, if Fred, thank you for the call. If they know everything, I mean, why don't they? Gee, there's a lot of, you know, if you knew everything, think of the things that you could warn about and predict. And they would know which banksters were doing what and where the stock market was going to go. And the NSA could make start making some serious money speculating. And oh, boy, that's a nice thing. 20 minutes past the hour. Past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you and Marty in Evergreen Park, Illinois. Hey, Marty, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Happy Friday the 13th.
Thank you.
I just wanted to chime in and bring up a topic that I don't think has gotten a lot of coverage in the mainstream media. That's the level of air pollution in Shanghai, China.
Mm-hmm.
And the pictures I've seen that have been circulating recently, they're just really dramatic. The level of air pollution there is off the charts. And I just have a feeling if we don't get our environmental laws and carbon emissions under control, we could foresee a very similar scenario here. And I just think that it's scary that there's an area in our troposphere where air pollution is really this bad. But
well, and it ends up here. The air that is over Shanghai is over Evergreen Park, Illinois, probably 8 or 10 days later. The world turns, literally.
Absolutely. Well, the pollution index surged to a record 482 micrograms per cubic meter on December 6th, reaching the highest severe level. That was according to China Daily. And in fact, you could actually the smog that was covering the city could actually be seen from space.
Mm-hmm.
The moderate resolution imaging spectral radiometer on NASA's Terra satellite acquired an image on December 7th, which showed a thick haze that stretched from Beijing to Shanghai. And that's about the same distance between Boston and Raleigh, North Carolina.
Right. This is the industrial corridor for China.
Right, right. And you can just see these. You could just, yeah, I mean, it's just clearly visible. And, you know, it's really dangerous. Today they announced that they warned the children and elderly to avoid prolonged or heavy outdoor activities.
Right.
As readings today hit seven times the World Health Organization's recommended
right.
level of daily exposure.
The reason, Marty, that that's happening in China and not in Chicago is because we have passed laws, going back to the 70s, really, when we created the Environmental Protection Agency, we have passed laws to make it very expensive to do that kind of thing. And so companies don't do that here. They don't pollute that way here. Yes, we have a problem with carbon pollution, but it's mostly carbon dioxide or, in some cases, methane, both of which are transparent gases. They're invisible gases. What you're talking about in Beijing and in Shanghai and in the economic corridor in between is particulate matter, is smog. It's the junk that comes out of smokestacks, you know, and particularly from coal-fired power plants. But also from factories that we have banned. And so what's happened is Americans, we're buying the products. We and the Western Europeans, we're buying the products that they're making in that part of China. But instead, we used to make those things here. And we used to make them in ways that were really, really dirty. The Cuyahoga River caught on fire back in the late 60s. The Lake Erie of the Great Lakes, you know, this massive body of water was completely dead in the late 60s, early 70s. And Rachel Carson woke us up in the mid 60s, and we really got active in the 70s with this environmental movement and said, no, we're not going to do this anymore. And so corporations, you know, that were manufacturing here in the United States, they said, okay, well, you know, it's more expensive to manufacture in a way that's clean, but we will do it, and we did it. And so we're going to have to pay our employees a little more, and you know, so they can buy our goods and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And that happened, you know, wages continued to go up, prices went up, but it wasn't, you know, so much because of the pollution controls. But then when we got into these trade deals in the 80s and the 90s, where China was given most favored nation status and you know, let's fulfill the, you know, Nixon opens China thing, during the Reagan administration, and then Bill Clinton with NAFTA and CAFTA and SHAFTA and GATT and WTO and all this stuff. All of that stuff basically said to the American companies, you want to go back to making things in the good old dirty way that you did back in the 1950s. I mean, my dad in the 50s worked, in 1951, worked in an Alcoa factory, literally in a cloud of asbestos dust. And it's what killed him. He died of mesothelioma, which is from, you know, cancer caused by, uniquely caused by asbestos. So our company said, hey, let's go back to doing that kind of 1950s manufacturing that we had here in the United States that polluted our lakes, polluted our rivers, polluted our land, killed our people. Only now we can do it in China because they don't have the rules. They don't have the EPA. They don't have the, you know, the environmental protections. And as China starts to clean up their act, they're going to move to Vietnam. And when Vietnam starts cleaning up their act, they'll move to Laos. And when Laos starts cleaning up their act, they'll move to Kenya. And when Kenya starts cleaning up their act, they'll move to Uganda. And when Uganda starts cleaning up their act, they'll move to the Democratic Republic of Congo. And I think I'm kind of going down the order of countries as they're getting poorer and poorer and poorer. And it's, you know, Bernie Sanders points out in this program and has done it many times that the president of GE once said, if I could put my factories on a barge and simply move them from a low wage country to low wage country as the wages goes up, I would do it. And, you know, it's just not practical. So making sense, Marty?
Oh, absolutely. Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the cure to it is bringing back industry back to here.
Yes.
So that way we're not.
And the only way you're going to do that is with tariffs, as Bernie said in the first hour.
Yeah. Well, we have to get a push going for that.
Yeah, I think we do. You know, let's put import taxes on goods. Let's put that giant condom over the United States once again. Let's put an economic membrane around the United States. Other countries have one. You know, China has one. That, you know, you can't import into China. You can't sell cheap American goods in China without considerable. You can't import into Japan. You can't import into South Korea. You don't, you know, American goods might be status symbols in those countries, but they're not sold by and large because those countries either have explicit tariffs or they have trade policies that have the serve the function of tariffs. And we're the stupid one. We're the one country in the world that stands alone and stands naked. And then, you know, well, actually, you could argue that Greece and Spain and Ireland, Portugal, and all these other countries that decided to join the EU so that they could all be part of a giant trading bloc, they essentially did the same thing. And Germany is pulling their chain, whereas China is pulling ours. Well, Germany is pulling our chain, too. But, you know, we're all, you know, it's just our trade policies are crazy. Marty, I'm with you. Thank you for the call. And by the way, if we brought the trade back here, it would clean up China. Well, that'd be nice.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Or they would start manufacturing goods for their own middle class. The Chinese middle class is now larger than the American middle class. And their middle class would start demanding clean air. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Very interesting. Let's see here. It's Anything Goes Friday the 13th. The other prevalent rationale for why Friday the 13th is considered unlucky is that there's a tradition in Christianity that Jesus was executed, was put on the cross, crucified on a Friday, and that might have been a 13th, or that Judas was the 13th disciple or something. It doesn't quite make as much sense as Esther, but who knows. David, in Mamaroneck, I don't know how to say that, in New York. I've read it so many times, but I don't know how to say it. How do you say it, David?
Hi, good afternoon. Mamaroneck.
Thank you. Mamaroneck. Okay. What's up?
Hi. I wanted to comment on your book. Not critique it. I love the book. I like the premise.
You're talking the crash of 2016?
Yes, the crash of 2016. The first thing, I have six items I'd like to just mention quickly, and the only reason I would mention them is I thought your book, the only critique I had is I wish your book was stronger, actually.
Okay.
In making this case. The first one is a question, rather. I know that you're very knowledgeable about the environment, and I was just wondering why you didn't make a case for the environment in the book.
Well, we do to a certain extent. On page 250 and 251, I talk about how all these companies are making they're not paying for the externalities associated with climate change and with carbon pollution. And if they did, then we could rein in climate change, and B, we could rebuild our economy, and we could move to a non-fossil fuel economy. Earlier in the book, I forget the page numbers, but earlier in the book also I talk about, how climate change was part of the, the war on climate change, the war on the scientists was part of the same people who were doing the war on tobacco science and whatnot. But basically, the crash of 2016 is about how from 1971 until today, this conservative meme has been built up, and the conservative power has been built up, and it has made the rich vastly richer, but it has also, made our economy so fragile that it's about to fall over. And the tipping process started in 2007, 2008. We half tipped over. Obama kind of pulled us back a little bit, but we're still way tipped over. And the fundamentals have not been changed. And if we don't change the fundamentals, the economy is going to fall over. And I think before the next presidential election, or soon thereafter.
I like the book, and I was just commenting that I know you have the website about
lasthours.org. We did a video on it.
And I know you're much more knowledgeable.
I really wanted to separate the topics. The crash of 2016 is about politics and economics, and lasthours.org is about extinction and methane, and the methane time bomb in the Arctic and those kind of things. And
you know what? I don't want to monopolize my time. I'll just mention these five items quick, and then let you comment on them.
Okay, rapid fire.
The first one is I was looking. I thought that your book might mention. The natural gas hype that we're all getting,
right?
The fact that shale or tight oil uses copious amounts of natural gas to get out of the ground. Tar sands uses natural gas.
Yeah.
The estimate in the Marcellus well was originally estimated to be 410 trillion cubic feet, and turned out to be 84 trillion cubic feet. There's an article in Bloomberg.
Yeah.
News in 2000.
Dave, again, then thank you for the call. The crash of 2016 is about economics and politics. I'm very respectful of your statistics on global warming and climate change, but that's a whole. I actually wrote another book about that called Last Hours of Humanity, which you can buy as an ebook on Amazon, or you can get for free. You can download the PDF for free over at lasthours.org. Jim in Pensacola, Florida. Hey, Jim.
Hello.
You are on the air, sir.
Oh, yeah, finally. Okay, that's my first time being on your show. And,
thank you.
Yes, okay, no problem.
So what's up?
Well, I'm not here to talk about politics or anything like that. And I am here to talk about cancer, because I just find out my mom has cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And I was watching a documentary online about injection therapy. I'd like to know what you know about that.
Injection therapy?
No, like the Max Gerson therapy. I don't know.
Oh, Max Gerson therapy? I don't know anything about it. I'm sorry. There's,
It would.
Go ahead.
Yeah, if you could do some research, do a little segment on that, that would be great.
Okay, I'll keep an open mind. Thank you for the call, Jim. The bottom line is, I'm relatively familiar with cancer. My almost son-in-law recently died of it. My wife had it. I had it. One of our kids had it. My father died of it. I've paid a lot of attention to cancer in my life. And, knock on wood, hopefully everybody's clear and fine now. But this is something that 1 in 3 Americans will have cancer at some point in their lives right now. And that is not a statistic, to the best of my knowledge, that existed 70 years ago or 100 years ago, before we really started the chemical age. And I think that we live in a toxic environment. Bill Moyers had his blood tested. There were over 100 carcinogenic chemicals measured in his blood. This was some years ago. But I think that's probably true of all of us. And so I think we live in a toxic environment. And I don't think there's any easy cures. Jeff in Shelton, Washington. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
Howdy.
You want to talk about amending the Constitution?
Yeah. You guys talk a lot about, you know, the different things that are going on in the news, and it's obvious across the board, and you talk about it, too, about getting money out of politics.
Mm-hmm.
You know, talk about move to amend, and I applaud that. You know, they're doing really important work. But a lot of the things, when people talk about it, you know, there's a lot of... So I know you know the Constitution pretty well. You pull it out a lot. And in Article 5, you know, people talk about there's only two ways to amend the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
One way is that Congress can do it. And, well, we all know what Congress is capable of at the federal level.
Right.
And the other way is that the states can do it. The state legislatures can actually call for a convention.
That's correct. Three-quarters of them.
No, it requires three-quarters of the states to ratify anything that comes out of that convention.
Mm-hmm.
You need two-thirds of the states to call
for it. Oh, two-thirds of the states. You're correct. I'm reading it right now. Thank you.
34 states.
Right.
And so so what would happen is that they would have a convention, which is like the legal term for like a meeting, and they'd talk about if the Constitution needs to be amended, yada, yada. And then if it produces any proposed amendments, then it goes back to the states to ratify it, just as if two-thirds of Congress has done it, which has always been the way that it's been done.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just kind of curious how come people don't I want to hear about that more in the mainstream media. I hear a lot of people being afraid of it. The John Birch Society likes to promote that a runaway convention is a big, scary thing.
Mm-hmm.
I catch your content every day, but not the whole show. So I'm curious, have you really addressed that fear of a runaway convention?
We have, and I have been promulgating that fear for some time. And David Cobb from MoveToAmend.org set me straight on this. And so here's my understanding of it. David is the real scholar on this stuff. He's also an attorney, and I'm not. And he's a constitutional scholar, and I'm not. But his point was that, you know, there are, as you point out, there's two ways to amend the Constitution. One is basically enough states call for it that it gets pushed into the lap of Congress and Congress has to deal with it, or it simply happens. And the second is that Congress decides to put forward an amendment to the Constitution, and then they push it out to the states after it's passed through the House and Senate. And the first way, where it originates in the states, is referred to as an Article 5 convention. And it doesn't mean that there's actually necessarily a big meeting where all the states get together and say, okay, let's amend the Constitution. Now, what shall we talk about? Oh, well, let's write into the Constitution that corporations are people instead of not people. Let's make our Constitution just like South Africa's, where corporations actually are people. And, you know, in the Constitution, because, you know, three big American companies sent lawyers over to help Nelson Mandela write the Constitution back in the day. And no, we're not going to do that. That was my concern, and because I thought that a constitutional convention meant that there was an actual convention. But what David said is if there is a constitutional amendment, a single amendment that is passed through the legislatures of these two-thirds of the states, that then is the convention. That's considered the convention for the purposes of Article 5. And then it gets, my recollection is, it then gets thrown to Congress. Congress has to ratify it, and then it goes back to the states for three-quarters of the states. But I probably have this wrong. I should get David back on and have him explain it to us. But the point is, Jeff, that it doesn't need to be a big meeting. It can just be a single amendment, and that's an Article 5 constitutional convention as well.
Sure, but I can actually address that. So I volunteer for a super PAC called Wolf PAC. And we're the super PAC looking to put super PACs out of business.
Uh-huh.
And so the way that it was explained to me by our lawyers is that if it depends on what the states put in their resolutions. Each state, you know, defines what the problem is, the goal of, you know, what the resolution is.
But, right.
Like, you and I don't have a say as to what that amendment could be. It's up to the delegate. You know, each state sends a team or how many or as few as they want to go have that convention. If they call for a convention, the convention happens.
Right, right. Interesting. Okay, Jeff, thank you for the call. I hang on.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Taylor, we're going to get David Cobb back on from Move to Amend. And Jeff, you know, look for it and call when David's on. And I'll bring this up with you. Thank you. And welcome back, Mary, in Stevens Point, Wisconsin. Mary, welcome. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV and welcome to the program.
Thank you, and hello, Tom. I'm calling because I listen to viewers or other people talk about how we repeat the same mistakes historically, and I don't believe that we repeat the same mistakes. I think it's quite intentional. I think, for example, when England went into Ireland under Queen Elizabeth, they intentionally broke up the land, parceled out land so that families couldn't survive on the land, and so it displaced a tremendous amount of people. We did the same thing with the Native Americans here in the States.
Sure.
Parcels up lands and displaced people. And the same thing when we go to war. We say the most atrocious, racist, bigoted things possible, and it has worked in the past. The variable now that I think is really important is people do not buy into these illogical, racist arguments any longer.
Mm-hmm.
When you look at our last war in Iraq, it was based on untruth and prejudices, and the thing that I found uplifting is there were so many people who didn't buy into that, and I mm-hmm. think that is amazing that we are growing so much, and with what's going on in this country with the breakdown of the middle class, is that people are recognizing that, oh my gosh, this could be me. I know people in the middle class. I know this isn't true.
Yeah.
And that's the amazing thing. People are learning.
I agree. And to take it even a step further, you know, President Obama wanted to have a war in Syria, and we the people stopped him.
Yes, yes, and that's uplifting. That's amazing.
That's amazing.
Yes, that we learned this. That we learned this in the power of the people.
Yeah.
Once we get together, we are, you know, just magnificent.
Yeah, but every 80 years, it seems like, you know, the generation who learns the lesson, the generation that was alive in the 20s, that saw Harding and Coolidge and Hoover's economic policies and saw them collapse and saw the failure of those policies, that generation was basically dead, or at least nobody was paying attention to them by the time 1999 came along and it was time to discuss, you know, to pass Gramm-Leach-Bliley and the Commodity Futures Modernization Act, and for example. And so it wasn't, I agree with you, it's intentional. It's the same predators playing the same game, knowing that they're going to get rich playing that game and other people are going to get hurt. I agree with that. The difference is that the people who remember that game, I mean, if you had gone before Congress in the 1950s or the 1960s or even the 1970s and said, you know, let's blow up the unions, let's make it harder to unionize, let's blow up the Glass-Steagall, let's let commercial and investment banks merge, you would have been laughed out of Congress. You know, in no way would you have gotten a congressional majority to go along with that. But by 1999, the people who remembered, you know, when that was done during the Coolidge and Harding administrations back in the 20s, those people were dead. And so, you know, you had a few young people who were reading out of history books, but that was about it. And everybody was saying, oh, these are different times, and we could do it differently, and the rules are different. No, you know, the fundamentals are the same.
But, and the other thing is it really takes a lot of effort for them to help us to forget our history. I mean, look at the way they redo the education book.
Yeah.
They've underfunded the school. It takes a tremendous effort to make the dumb down.
I agree. And then, you know, you corporatize all the media, and you do away with the fairness doctrine that required actual news to come out of news departments, and you have courts that say that, you know, the news can lie, and it's amazing. Mary, thank you for the call. Hey, thanks so much to our show director, Louise Hartman, to my executive producer, Sean Taylor, to our associate producers, Shane Farnan and Danielle Gilday, to our video director, Jim Javinsky, to our writer-researchers, Andrew Campbell and Nate Sweet, to Alva Goldbook for video production, to our webmasters, Nigel Peacock and Jamie Holly, to our business manager, Ron Hartenbaum, to all of the people at the various companies that syndicate our program, Westwood One, Pacifica Radio, Sirius XM Satellite Radios, Cable Radio Network, Free Speech TV, Dish Network, DirecTV, all the cable providers that carry our show, Comcast, Manhattan Neighborhood Network, all the great folks at Free Speech TV and RTTV who work on The Big Picture, the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn, to our newsletter editor, Sue Nethercutt, the folks in our chat room, hey, to Ellen Ratner, Victoria Jones, Bob Ney, and everyone at the Talk Radio News Service, to Jay Goodman Tamboli for tech support, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you for supporting our program. Thank you. Sincerely meant. Dwayne in Petaluma, California. Hey, Dwayne, what's up?
Hey, yeah. Before I get to a celebration for the 100th anniversary of the Fed coming December 23rd, I do want to tell you how much I enjoyed your book.
Thank you.
I enjoy your talking about the multi-generational forgetting and the crash, real estate crash of, I think, 26 that led to the stock market crash of 29 and comparing that to our current cycle. Really enjoyed the book. I want to mention that the Federal Reserve was passed, and it seems like in the dead of night on December 23rd, 13, and that they passed a bill that essentially gave the control of our banking and our credit to a semi-private agency, and that agency since then has basically overseen. Crashes and bubbles and crashes and bubbles. The things that it was in, at least as the public was told, was supposed to bring us a stop to.
Yeah.
And instead, it seems like it made it so that insiders can borrow money to profit from those. If I wanted to see an audit of the Fed, it would be for the years 1929 to 1932 to see who was borrowing big money at that point.
That would be very interesting.
The people should be up in arms about the Fed. They should be upset that they could have solved our problem here. Many of the people who lost the houses because they had been given teaser loans, 3% loans, and then when they ballooned up to a full percentage, they lost their houses.
Mm-hmm.
And it would have been real easy for the Fed to have simply bought up all the teaser loans that people were paying on time and keep a million people in their houses. It would have been real simple for the Fed to have done that, but that's not what they're interested in. We've got a 12 bankers or lawyers for banks sitting on the open market committee, and they're interested in seeing that their friends have the money needed to buy up the assets during a crash, and that's what it's all about.
I don't disagree. I don't think that's what it's all about, but I think that there is a very big piece of the banker class knows how to look out for its own. And, you know, the banks are there for the banksters. And I would like to see my argument, and I think that Bernie Sanders has said something similar to this, although I can't be certain. But my recollection is that the Fed should be brought under the Treasury Department. It should become, you know, part of our government. There's like this loophole in the Constitution that allowed the creation of the Fed. And that is that the Constitution says that Congress shall authorize the coinage of money and to determine the value of the coins. And so the way that it's phrased in Article 1, Section 8 caused them to say, well, you know, the coins will continue to be produced by the Treasury. And, here it is. To coin money, regulate the value thereof and of foreign coin, and fix the standard of weights and measures. It's Article 1, Section 8, Paragraph 5. So they said, fine, we'll let the coins still be manufactured by the Treasury Department and still represent value defined by the Treasury Department. So the quarters and half dollars and nickels and dimes and pennies that you have are actual U.S. money, minted by the Treasury Department and issued by the U.S. government. But because paper money is not mentioned in Article 1, Section 8, Paragraph 5, then paper money could be created by a private bank. And I don't think that that's what the founders intended. I don't think that that's consistent with the Constitution. I think by coins, they meant script as well, although at the creation of the country, there was a lot of skepticism about script and whether it would ever be valid. And maybe they were reluctant to write it into the Constitution because of their fear of it. But basically, we have not only paper money now, but we have electronic money. And all of this money that exists on paper and it exists as electrons all over the world, and it's hundreds of trillions of dollars now in electrons when you look at the gray and black markets for derivatives, is all, you know, arguably money that's answerable to the Fed, not to the United States government. So I think the Fed should be taken out of the Treasury Department. Does that make sense, Dwayne?
Your comments are true. I wanted to say that Thomas Jefferson would even go further. He made clear in a letter he wrote in 1813 that the federal government, in his view, didn't have the power to even have set up the Hamilton's first bank.
Oh, yeah. Well, him and Hamilton had huge, you know, battles over that, although he stopped fighting it during the years that he was president, from 1800 to 1801 to 1809, I believe.
Well, he said if it got passed, he'd honor it until they could oppose it.
He also said, though, that banks are more to be feared than armies.
Yes. The point being, though, is that the Congress meeting in 1913 basically took a power that they didn't have, at least according to Jefferson. I agree with you. Jefferson said they didn't even have the power to set up a bank. That
right.
The states had the powers to regulate banks and had done so for most of our history.
Right.
And they took that power and handed it to a semi-private organization.
I agree, and I share your outrage, Duane, and I think that if we're going to have a national bank, it should be under the Treasury Department. And if we're not, I think every state should have its own bank and let them compete with the corporate banks. I'm with Ellen Brown on this. Go over to webofdebt.com. You can read her book and you can read her writings on it. It's very, very clear. Duane, thanks for the call. And so coming up Monday, will they or won't they? Will Senate Republicans block the budget deal, cause another government shutdown? We'll update you on that and all the other information you won't hear from the corporate-owned news media. And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It begins with you. Get out there, get active. Get over to movetoamend.org or pdamerica.org. Occupy something. On the internet, tag you're it.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. Edison Factor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartman.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartman.com. Thank you.